Okay, so I now bring you news from the Edelweiss experiment. I will talk mainly about the first phase of Edelweiss. I'd like some nice results with our previous experiments that have been accepted for publication. And then I will move on to the second phase of the Edelweiss 2 experiment, the next generation experiment. So, Edelweiss is l'expérience pour détecter les vis en site souterrain, a French wind direct detection experiment which is located in a deep site underground. It brings together collaborators from several French labs and some astrophysicists, nuclear physicists, low temperature physicists, solid state physicists, and some particle physicists, and also two very dedicated technicians who work in the underground lab at Lugan where the experiment is. So direct searches for winds are little background experiments. And to reduce the background, these experiments are all on deep sites underground. In Europe, there are several such sites. There's, for instance, the Canfranc train tunnel in the Pyrenees, between the equivalent of 2.5 kilometers of water. This is where the Rosebud experiment is, or the IGES experiment. In England, there's the Woolby Potash mine, where the UKDMC collaboration is. In France, we have the Roussel underground lab. This is sort of interesting because this used to be the headquarters of the French land-based nuclear strike force. And so it's been reconverted into a slightly shallow underground lab since then. And the largest underground lab that I know of in Europe is the Grand Sasso Laboratories in Italy. These are really huge cavities with fairly good protection. There are a great number of experiments. There are neutrino experiments, for instance, Burattino, dark matter experiments like CREST or the Domino experiment or the Hydro-Rosso experiments. Now, the lab that we work in is the underground lab at Lugan, the Alexander.
This is beneath the equivalent of. Can you hear me without that? Oh. Okay, so for posterity then. Can you still hear me? Okay. So Modane is under 4,500 meters water equivalent of rock. The muon flux is reduced compared to the surface by about 6 orders of magnitude to around 4 per square meter and per day. And an important number for our background considerations is the fast neutron flux, which is reduced to about, well, which is around 1.6 times 10 to the minus 6 per square centimeter and per second. I should mention that Modane is actually a highway tunnel between France and Italy. And so another very important number to get into the tunnel is the number of trucks going through it. And there are quite a few of them, all the more so that the only other tunnel between France and Italy, the Mont Blanc tunnel, was closed for a while because of a fire. So this makes getting to the lab a bit hairy at times because you have to cross the highway and avoid the trucks hell-bent on making it through the tunnel. So the types of detectors that we use underground are ionization phonon detectors. These were originally first brought to maturity by the CDMS experiment, and we've made our own more recently. The way these detectors function is the following. First of all, it's essentially a calorimeter in which we have a fairly large absorber crystal. Now, a particle will come into this and scatter off something, creating a recoil. And this recoil releases phonons that can make their way to a thermometer, which is a heat sunk to something in the cryostat. And the thermometer is, in fact, a thermistor, so we read a variation in the resistance of the thermometer. Now, the thermal phonon signal is, in fact, inversely proportional to the heat capacities involved. And since for dielectric crystals, the heat capacity go like the temperature cube, to maximize the signal, we have to minimize the heat capacity and therefore work at very low temperatures, typically of the order of 10 to 20 millikelvin. Despite these very low temperatures, the signal still remains small. We just have a relative heat elevation of around 1 part per thousand. But we can measure this using special FET electronics. And the typical duration of this signal would be of the order of a few milliseconds. Now, that's a standard calorimeter. The ionization phonon detectors have another channel. This is because the absorber crystal is made out of semiconducting material, either germanium or silicon in general. And so the incoming particle not only releases phonons, but also some electron and hole pairs. And if the surfaces of this semiconducting crystal have been properly prepared to make them electrodes, one can apply a bias voltage across these electrodes and therefore collect and count these electron hole pairs. And this gives us a second signal, an ionization signal, in addition to the phonon signal. Now, this ionization signal is also quite small, around 1,000, but with nice electronics, we can read it out. And I'd just like to point out that this ionization signal is typically much faster than the phonon signal, so it's the signal that we will use as a trigger. Now, the point of having this double measurement of phonons and charge is that the photon and the electron background interact in the detector by ionizing much more than the WIMP signal that we're looking for in the neutron background signal do. So by measuring for each event the ionization and the phonons, we're able to have an event-by-event rejection of the background and identify each particle. And this works down to fairly low energies, and this is the great advantage of this type of detector over other heavier and longer established types of detectors, such as classical ionization detectors where you just measure the ionization, or standard scintillation detectors where you just measure some photons. These detectors did have some growing pains when they were being developed initially, unfortunately, and that is because in a typical ionization detector, one can apply a bias voltage of several kilovolts, and therefore when it's fairly sure of properly collecting the charges. However, since we're also measuring a phonon signal, there's something analogous to joule resistive heating, except for it takes place in a semiconductor here. And if we apply too high a bias voltage to collect the charges, in fact, we wind up heating the detector, and therefore we correlate completely the charge and phonon signal, and therefore we can't separate the two types of particles. So this limits us to fairly low bias voltages of the order of a few volts. And this means that there did appear to be some problems with miscollected charge for surface events that occurred on the surface of the detector. However, there are many ideas that have been put into place to reduce this problem. So Edelweiss in 2002, we have deployed three 320-gram germanium phonon ionization devices. Here is a picture of one of them. That's the germanium, the shiny germanium crystal. The typical diameter is 70 millimeters. Its edges are beveled. It's held in a low radioactive background copper housing. The thermistor that we use is an NTD, which is glued onto one of the beveled edges. And the electrodes are made out of sputtered aluminum. Now, in 2002, we stacked three such devices and put them in the cryostat underground at LSM. And we also tested several countermeasures against the surface events. The first countermeasure that we tested was common to all three detectors, and that was that the three detectors had double electrodes. So first, we have this outer electrode here on the beveled edges of the detector. And this outer electrode, first of all, on the one hand, its electrical field is probably not very homogeneous because of the shape. So it's not very good for collecting charges properly. And moreover, since this outer electrode here is also more exposed to radioactive contaminations from outside, so this means that there is a greater chance that there would be surface events in this outer electrode, in particular coming, for instance, from the NTD itself, which is usually quite radioactively hot. So that's the outer electrode. And then inside, in this nice flat surface here, we have the inner electrode, where we have a nice homogeneous electrical field. And also, since the detectors are stacked upon each other, and since in principle nothing should be cleaner than the detectors, this should be fairly shielded from exterior radioactive contaminations. So it's with this inner electrode that we will define the fiducial volume of the detector. Now, another countermeasure against surface events that we tested on one of the detectors was a special surface treatment beneath the electrodes consisting of amorphous germanium. So the three detectors were brought underground to Modane. And the first thing that we do is we do an energy calibration using a photon source, in this case cobalt-57, which gives 122 keV photons. And we obtained the following plots for the three detectors. Now, these plots here show the ratio of ionization over recoil energy as a function of the recoil energy here. This is for the three detectors. And in blue here, we have the region where all the electron recoils from photons and electrons should be, assuming they are properly collected. In red here, We have the region where the nuclear recoil should be. These are the nuclear recoils which would come from the WIMP signal or a neutron background. And I also just point out here in green, this green hyperbola is the threshold which comes from the constant ionization trigger. So we see that the three detectors behave differently for this photon calibration. In the case of detector number one here, we have most of the 122 keV photons nicely collected here within the blue zone, and we see very few events drifting down into the rest of the detector. On the other hand, in the other two detectors, those that do not have the special surface treatment, we see that the 122 keV peak here drools all the way down into the area where we expect the signal. This means that these detectors aren't functioning too well and still suffer from this problem of surface events. We can actually quantify the performance of the detector. We use as a measure a calibration with cobalt-60. Cobalt-60 gives MeV photons, which give Comptons uniformly in the detector. In the case of a cobalt-60 calibration, 99.99% of the background events would be rejected, would not fall in this nice red zone here. Whereas in the case of the other two detectors, we would have, well, relatively many miscollected surface events, and we'd only have a 98% background rejection in this case. So it's based upon these calibrations that we select which detector we will use for the background run. So we make the selection a priori before taking any background data. And we see that we have one detector which is actually functioning very well and which will reject most of the background. However, with great power comes great responsibility. So we must check that this detector would actually see a signal should one occur. So for that, we do a neutron calibration using a 252 californium source. And this is the plot that we obtain. Once again, this is the ionization over recoil ratio as a function of the recoil energy here. In blue, we have the region where the electron recoil background should be. We see that there are quite a few events that sneak in with the from the californium source. And in red here, we have the nuclear recoil band, which is calibrated with the neutrons. And we see that we have all the events down here. So this seems to be functioning quite well. So this demonstrates that this detector has very good separation down to around 15 keV here, 15 keV true recoil energy. And we'll also use this neutron calibration to define the fiducial volume of the detector. I'll say more on that just later. Just in case there are any nuclear physicists in the audience, I'll just point out that we also see some inelastic scattering on germanium-73 here, this line here. This is where we'd have a photon emitted at the same time as there was a nuclear recoil. Okay, so defining the fiducial volume of the detector, this is being wrapped up by Oliver Martineau in his PhD thesis. As I said, our detector has two electrodes, and we define fiducial events by those which have more than 75% of their charge on the inner electrode. Now, we'd like to quantify which fraction of the total volume this makes. And to do that, we have to find some interaction, which arrives uniformly throughout the detector. And in fact, we have two of these, which are completely independent. On the one hand, we have the neutron calibrations, once they're corrected for multiple scatters within a detector. And on the other hand, we can also study bulk cosmogenic contaminations in the background run, for instance, zinc-65. And anyways, both of these two independent methods give consistent results, and this shows that the fiducial volume of our detector is around 57% of the total detector volume. Okay, the threshold. The threshold is set by the ionization detector, and to study its efficiency, once again, we have two independent methods. We have neutron calibrations, where we can study low energy events and see which events we see in a given detector that were actually triggered by this detector and which events were triggered by another detector. And we can also compare our cobalt-60 calibration with a Monte Carlo and see how quickly we reach the expected Compton plateau. Both of these techniques give consistent results. We reach 50% efficiency at 3.7 keV electron equivalent. So this means that for true recoils, we have a 99% threshold efficiency above 20 kV. So once again, these are recoil energies. So we now come to the background run. After these in-situ calibrations, we take the sources away, and we see what happens in the detectors. These data were taken from February to May of this year. We didn't go any longer because we had cryogenic problems with the cryostat and warmed up accidentally. So we only look at the, I only show the data here from the best detector as selected from the calibrations beforehand. And we have 7.4 kilogram days effective exposure. Once again, this is the ionization over recoil ratio as a function of the recoil energy. Here's our 20 keV recoil threshold. In red is the area where all the signal will be. And I will ask for audience participation here to see how many events we have above threshold.
We have one just below threshold.
Yes, there's one. Yeah, there's one slightly below threshold. Yeah, there's one event here. This event is sort of marginal, but okay, we'll include it in our analysis. In fact, it turns out that this event is practically irrelevant for most WIMP masses. This is because the expected WIMP spectra are exponentially decaying. We see some examples here. This is the rate of expected events per day per kilogram of detector and per keV of recoil energy as a function of the recoil energy. We see a 10 GeV WIMP mass would give a very steep spectrum, whereas heavier WIMPs would give much flatter spectrums. So the lighter the WIMP is, the lower the expected recoil energies are. And it turns out that the observed recoil that we observe at 119 keV is in fact irrelevant for WIMPs lighter than 10 keV. This is irrelevant in the sense that for lighter WIMPs than that, more than 95% of the signal is expected below 120 keV. So this event that we do observe doesn't affect, hardly affects the limits below 10 keV. Okay. So a few words about the data set. In 2001, we had a previous run with a slightly higher threshold, 30 keV, smaller exposure, 4.3 kilogram days. And in these data, we saw no events at all. In the more recent data, therefore, well, in the more recent data, we had a 20 keV threshold because of improvements on the ionization channel, a larger exposure, and this one event at 119 keV. So we combined the two and obtained the following limits. So these limits, first of all, are done using the standard assumptions that we make. These assumptions are of two nature. First of all, they're sort of the particle physics assumptions, which are, for instance, that the cross-section is completely spin-independent, that it scales like a squared, and we use the standard form factor. We also make the standard astrophysical assumptions, a local density of 0.3 GeV per cubic centimeter and an RMS speed of 270 kilometers per second. The good news is that most of the experiments have also agreed on using these standard assumptions to make the comparisons. The bad news is that perhaps this isn't the optimum or the fullest description of the halo. Maybe that's something for the theorists to give us more input on. And anyways, so this is the result that we obtained. These are 90% confidence level limits. This is the cross-section normalized to the nucleon. This is the WIMP on nucleon cross-section. As a function of the WIMP mass in GeV here, these green and dashed black areas are some supersymmetric predictions from some theorists. These are variations on the minimal supersymmetric model. And what do we have here? First of all, in blue here, this is the three sigma zone claimed by the Dama sodium iodine experiment. They say they observe a modulation in their detector over the course of 4 years, and they interpret this as a WIMP. This is the most likely value of this zone, and using a slightly different analysis, they obtain this most likely value. In green here, we have a limit from an ionization detector. In pink here, the limit from the CDMS experiment. This limit is all the more remarkable that it was obtained in a very shallow site where the cosmic induced background was quite a problem. And in red here, we have our new limit from Edelweiss. So we see that new sensitivity has been reached by the Edelweiss experiment. And this is more or less incompatible with the DAM interpretation of its modulation as being a WIMP. Just if we want to compare these two experiments a bit further, DAMA has two variations on their WIMP, around 40 to 50 GeV mass, cross-section of 5 to 7 times 10 to the minus 6 picobarns. And if this were a WIMP, we would expect in our detector between 6 and 10 events, so between 20 and 60 keV recoil energy. In fact, we observe none at all. And the Poisson probability of this occurring is much less than 1%. So given the standard assumptions, these experiments are incompatible. And now there are two independent germanium experiments, CDMS and Edelweiss, that more or less rule out gamma given these assumptions. And this just shows that this is a fairly tricky business. And I think that in the future, to really see and confirm a WIMP signal, one will need various detectors with different types of nuclei and different types of techniques to avoid systematics. Okay. We will run the detector with the cryostat with three improved detectors till about the end of the year, hopefully get more mass. Then we move on to the second phase of Edelweiss, Edelweiss 2. This will be a larger experiment. We see the cryostat here. It's a novel design, reversed pulse tubes, very small helium consumption. Base temperature has been reached at the lab it's being constructed in Grenoble. We hope to start installing it underground in around March of next year. 21 germanium detectors have been funded for 2004. This will give an active mass around 7 kilograms. The cryostat has room and power for many more detectors, though. Okay, this is the setup. The sensitivity of this experiment. So Edelweiss 2 will be just one of three next-generation cryogenic experiments. They will all have in common a total active mass of around 10 kilograms. And these three experiments will also have background discrimination. In the case of CDMS 2 and Edelweiss 2, this will be from phonon and ionization. And in the case of CREST 2, this will be from scintillation and phonon. So the sensitivity that these experiments would expect in around 2 to 3 years exposure is the following. Once again, this is the cross-section as a function of the WIMP mass. This is the gamma modulation region. The filled lines here are the current limits. This pink area is a slightly outdated SUSY model. And the dashed lines are the sensitivities we expect. So we hope to get an improvement of two orders of magnitude over the course of 2 to 3 years. Now, this is assuming that no new ugly background rears its head. And one thing that we're starting to get worried about will be the neutron background, because our detectors can reject photon electron background, but not the neutron background. So this may become an issue. So we're studying that very closely. Let's say that neutrons from the natural radioactivity in the rock in the lab can be moderated with polyethylene. However, the problem may be the neutrons created by the rare muons that do make it into the underground lab and knock around either in the rock or in the lead shielding right around the detector. So we're doing Monte Carlos of this right now. And we're also, we have a student working on the muon veto. So we plan to veto these muons using a standard, just standard scintillating vetoes. This is being done in collaboration with the research center at Karlsruhe in Germany. And they've actually lent us some modules from what was the Karman experiment. And we may be able to recycle these to use as the vetoes for the experiment. Here we just have a picture of these modules being, two of these modules being set up for test at Modane Underground. This is just to study how to set the threshold of these veto modules in the underground site. So, we're also doing some R&D on making sure that we can get rid of these surface events. But to wrap up, Edelweiss now has the best spin independent limits on WIMPs of these experiments. For the time being, we're still limited by statistics. We would like to have three detectors with the surface treatment running underground sometime late this summer. The installation of the larger Edelweiss 2 experiment starts in the first quarter of 2002, and we hope to be online sometime early in 2004. The goals of Edelweiss 2 are sort of double. On the one hand, we do hope to gain this two orders of magnitude gain in the sensitivity of the experiment. And also, on the other hand, Edelweiss 2 can be seen as an advanced R&D experiment for a much larger international one-ton experiment. Now, I don't want to understate the challenges that these goals set us. So I'd just like to cite the great words of French author Marcel Proust, who said that toute action de l'esprit est aisée si elle n'est pas soumise au réel. And I think that I found an appropriate translation for that in English, and that translation would be easier said than done. Thank you.
Has DAMA capitulated?
Well, they have 2 years more data that they haven't published yet, so right now they're still fighting CDMS and Edelweiss, I guess.
In
your new setup is the analytics 2.
Yes.
That went by off the fact. You said you had reversed pulse.
No, it's a reversed cryostat using pulse tubes. It's two separate things. The design is reversed. Usually you have the cooling that comes from above and cools the detectors down low. This cryostat is sort of upside down, so in principle it makes it easier to access. Okay. And then for the cryogenics themselves, we use pulse tubes for the cooling, and this means that we use much less helium than a standard cryostat would. Yes?
I'm going to get rid of the neutron background to sort of capture the neutron after it scatters. Putting a detail on the outside, do you look at that at all?
No,
if
no.
If it's not lost. So if you can find it somewhere else, you
can do that. Okay, we haven't considered that yet, no. One other point for the neutrons would be that having the detectors very close packed also would be good for this, because you'd have a chance of having multiple scatters within the detector. So, yeah.
Let's thank Philippe again.